This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Bob Beaton on the 18th of December, 2001 at approximately 11:10. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Eaton is at, I forgot.
Where are you? In Brazil, Indiana.
That's right, Brazil, Indiana. Okay, sir, let's go ahead and pick up with the discussion of your entry into Air America. And after we ended our last interview discussing the battery of exams and whatnot that you had to take, and if you would just describe what happened after you finished all that when you heard that you were accepted and where you went from there.
I don't actually recall the sequence of exactly when I found that I had passed the exams and so forth, but the woman that gave the exams indicated to us that the results looked favorable at her quick glance. We probably ended up going back to the office in D.C. and hearing some more about where we might be going if we were hired and so forth. The interview actually was not so much an interview as it was an explanation of what they were doing and what we could expect, scrapbooks and all that kind of thing showing up. We were scheduled originally to go to Thailand. I don't remember when I took the exams. I think the total elapsed time from the first telegram indicating I should come and take the exams was that probably happened about March. And I ultimately arrived in the Far East in early June or late May. I think my official date of hire or my seniority date was the 2nd of June, I believe, of 1971. I don't remember exactly how I was informed. I guess it was a phone call, probably, that I was hired and had to get a passport and send all that stuff to D.C. for visas and so forth. And then I was sent tickets from Indianapolis via L.A., I believe, to Taipei, not knowing that there was anybody else hired at the same time. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, I met a fellow that I had briefly known in the Army in the airport at L.A., and it turned out he was going for the same job. So we rode over together, and upon arrival in Taipei, found that there were actually a total of five of us that were hired on at the same time.
Okay.
We were picked up by a local in Taipei, and in the car on the way to the hotel, we were informed that we were not going to Thailand, that everything had changed. We were going to Saigon, which caused a little consternation.
Yes, sir.
Particularly among the one fellow that was married and concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter to the rest of us, really, where we went.
Okay.
So we checked into the hotel there, did maybe 3 or 4 days processing in Taipei, which included a physical. And filled out a bunch of paperwork and, heard more sort of indoctrination or introduction, I should say, not indoctrination, as to where we'd be going, what we'd be doing, and who we were working with and so forth. And then got on the plane and went to Bangkok for some more processing there, from there to Vientiane for ground school.
Mm-hmm.
And spent maybe a week in Vientiane, I don't recall. And then flew from Vientiane direct to Saigon.
Okay.
And at Saigon, then we began another in-processing a deal there, to check through all the various personnel, security, and all that sort of thing, operations and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And began flying in early June.
Okay. Now, as you were going through this process, especially when you started arriving at in Southeast Asia, at Bangkok, Vientiane, and then Saigon, what kind of what was the content of the briefings you were receiving that you remember?
I don't really remember a whole lot because they weren't really telling us much that we didn't already know.
Okay.
It was basically just telling us sort of what our accommodations would be, mm-hmm. Everyday living sort of things. Mm-hmm. We didn't get into the operational aspects very much.
Okay.
That was sort of learn as you go kind of thing.
Yeah. How about rules regarding your activities, your personal activities?
We must have heard some. I don't remember a lot about that. I'm sure that somewhere along the line there was mentioned, probably an 8-hour cutoff between drinking and flying. Perhaps it was 12. I don't even remember now. It probably was 12 hours, actually. But I don't specifically remember. But that had been a problem on some occasions,
mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that was mentioned because it does stick in my mind as something that's kind of beat in our head, that In fact, there had been cases of somebody seen in a bar who was not drinking alcohol but was seen in a bar by a customer, and it caused some problems.
Wow.
So we were cautioned to be careful about where we were seen when we got within 12 hours of flying.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you know any of the guys that were going over with you? Had you met them previously?
Well, the one fellow that I met in L.A., I really knew him more, but I think I'd met him once at a party when I was in the Army.
Okay.
And I knew him more by call sign than I did by his face, because when I was flying dust off in Lac-Ké, mm-hmm. with Americans, he was in one of the outfits that used to support us quite frequently.
Hmm.
So I had talked with him on the radio any number of times, and I knew who he was. I think I'd met him once before.
Okay.
The other three I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you did arrive in Saigon, you just mentioned customers, and the example that a customer saw a pilot in a bar, and that caused some problems.
Uh-huh.
Did you know, was it explained to you who the customers were?
No, we were never told who the customers were.
Did you know, though?
Yes. In actual fact, customers weren't always agency people.
Hmm.
There was any number of folks we worked for. We had one contract while I was in Saigon that was for, it was a Navy contract, but the people we were actually carrying around were employees of RMK,
mm-hmm.
Morrison Knutson and that consortium,
mm-hmm.
Doing construction work for the Navy. And in fact, that was quite a nice job. And we did a lot of work for them, and then we worked for various other, USAID and the embassy and so forth and so on, and you never really knew who somebody really was,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't ask. It didn't matter.
Right. Okay. Well, what was it like when you arrived in Southeast Asia?
Well, I'd only been gone 6 months.
Right.
So it was certainly wasn't, I knew what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like coming home in a sense,
mm.
except it was better living there as a civilian than it was as a military guy.
Okay.
And in fact, I had gone down to my old unit, which was now down in the Delta, on a day off. I hitched a ride on a C-47 or something, and got down there and spent the day and saw some of the guys that were still there that I had worked with only 6 months before.
Oh.
So it was sort of like coming home in a sense.
Okay. Now, could you explain to them who you were working for?
Well, I told them that I was with Air America, and
okay.
of course they would see our helicopters around,
yeah.
because we had an operation based in Kanto,
yeah.
Which is where the unit was a couple of miles from there, so mm-hmm. they saw us, and it was no secret who we were, really.
Right. And when you got there in early June, that was June, I'm sorry, what year again?
June of 71.
That was 71. Well, when you got there, what were you explained as far as what your personal mission as a pilot would be?
Generally speaking, to fly at customer direction.
Okay.
The way it would work, you'd go in the morning, mm-hmm. and you'd find out sort of what contract you were on, which defined who the customer was.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what it was, nine times out of ten was, fly out to thus and so place and work at customer direction.
Mm-hmm.
So you just fly to, wherever you were told to begin your work,
mm-hmm.
and pick somebody up, and then they would tell you what they wanted you to do for the rest of the day.
Okay. Were you briefed about, something that's come up in previous interviews is sometimes what you were asked to do as pilots was quite dangerous and quite threatening. What kind of instructions did you receive regarding safety and maintenance of your aircraft in terms of, mission parameters?
Well, I know that it was pointed out that, look, you guys are civilians. You don't have to do anything crazy. You're not in the Army, and this guy's not a general. He can't, he can't force you to do anything. But that really, only once do I remember that ever becoming an issue, and I kind of took issue with the position at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Most all of us were in a get the job done mode,
mm-hmm.
and helicopter people, especially, and I can't speak for the fixed wing types, but I suspect in that environment a very similar mentality, or kind of independent sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And There are times when we don't take direction very well if we have our own idea what should happen.
Okay.
So that really never was much of a factor. That was pretty much those kind of decisions were made on an individual basis according to the you know, what things looked like and what you thought about the deal on site.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind that Saigon, the whole operation in Vietnam was much less threatening than it was in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't as directly involved in hostilities as were our counterparts in Laos. The real show was up there.
Mm-hmm.
Saigon was, for the most part, what the military used to call ash and trash. Just haul this low there, you know, pick these guys up, move them from here to there. But we weren't as directly involved in the hostilities as the guys in Laos were.
Okay.
At least in the early, when I arrived.
Yeah. Now, can you describe the circumstances that led you to question that particular mission?
Well, that was later on. Now, you sort of fast forward ahead a little bit.
Well, that's okay, because it's in the context of what we're talking about.
There was an Easter offensive in 72.
Yes, sir.
And it just so happened, in fact, if you want a little anecdote, this is kind of interesting, because I was flying up there with one of the old-timers,
mm-hmm.
Flying out of Quang Tri, which is, you know, the northernmost province.
Yes, sir.
And we were working for MACV that day, again, going to customers. Now, sometimes customers would be military people. So we were flying for MACV that day and doing the same thing we would do, you know, just say, take this load here, take this load there. And everything was normal. In fact, that morning, about 11 o'clock in the morning, we'd been up to a place called, the Americans would say GLN. I don't know how the Vietnamese pronounce it. They'll probably, if any Vietnamese listens to this tape, they'll think I'm slaughtering their language. But Americans would know it as GLN, which was just a couple of clicks below the DMZ, sort of our northernmost outpost at that point, the Vietnamese outpost.
Mm-hmm.
We'd been up there that morning, shut down for maybe a half hour while whoever we were carrying conferred with whoever he was talking with. And then we left, came back, and worked more to the west of Quang Tri, up into the mountains a little bit, to some fire bases. And about 1 o'clock that afternoon, we got a call from MACV on the radio telling us, if anybody wants to go north of the Qua Viet River, don't take them. And we said, why is that? And they said, because we don't own it anymore. And in the space of just a couple of hours,
mm-hmm.
The bad guys had essentially moved the DMZ down one river. The Qua Viet River is the mm-hmm. one that goes by Cam Lo and Dong Ha, as I recall. So, I mean, this thing just happened terribly fast. And when it happened, they captured friendly fire bases intact, and were turning the guns around and shooting our own stuff back at us. Later on that afternoon, we took a MACV American major out to a place called Mylock. He was going to look at a hospital. I think he was a doctor or something. And as we were landing him in there, they started taking incoming in that area. And as he was getting off the helicopter, the original arrangement had been to leave him there for 3 or 4 hours and come back and pick him up later in the day. And as he was leaving, we summoned him back to the helicopter and explained to him that, you know, this really doesn't look good, and all hell's breaking loose. Nobody knows what's going on, and we can't guarantee that we can get back in here to pick you up. And he was a little upset about the whole deal, but he said, oh, what the hell? So he canceled his program, got back on the helicopter, and left with us. And as far as I know, we were the last helicopter that was ever in Mylock until the end of the war. So had he decided to stay, it would have been a bad decision. I don't think he would have gotten out. In any event, and getting to what you were talking about, as the offensive progressed, there was any number of Air Force people getting shot down. And the whole thing had just become pandemonium. And at some point along the line, I think the SA-7 appeared, and nobody knew what the heck that was. And anyway, it was getting to be a bigger thing than anyone had been through since Tet of 68, probably. And our chief pilot came up from Saigon and was cautioning us to, the old thing, you guys are not in the military, you're not armed and all the rest, so be careful about, they're not paying you enough to do some of these things. And my response to that was, well, you know, they're not paying that guy who shot down the damn thing to be sitting on the ground and wait for somebody to pick him up. So that kind of irritated me at the time, because I didn't I was still in a mode, you know, if somebody shot down, you go pick them up. Don't leave it for the Jolly Greens or somebody else if you're right there.
Yes, sir.
And but that seemed to be sort of the attitude. And of course, as one grows older, you look at things a little differently. And perhaps there was some logic to what he was saying, because these guys were going down in very bad areas. And, you know, oftentimes one helicopter really wouldn't have had the assets to pull it off, I don't suppose. You know, it's no good if a crew of three goes in to pick up one guy, and then all of a sudden you end up with four guys on the ground looking for a ride out.
How much do you think that was the actual justification?
Well, I wouldn't presume to get into somebody else's mind.
Mm-hmm.
I can only say that, you know, that I did not necessarily agree with that position, but I wouldn't say that he was wrong either.
Yeah.
You know, this was somebody who'd been kicking around that part of the world for the last probably 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly had some background from which to say what he was saying.
Yes, sir.
And so I wouldn't debate that from this perspective now, although it kind of irritated me when I heard it.
Okay. Were there ever any missions before the Easter Offensive where you guys would get shot at, or was it routine that you would get shot at?
No, in Saigon it really wasn't routine to get shot at. It happened, certainly, on occasion. Usually unexpectedly. You know, we were shot at on occasion. We were hit on occasion. But it wasn't, you know, I was coming from a situation in the Army where we got shot at all the time. And it was the nature of the work that I was doing. So, really, what we were doing in Air America in Saigon, I thought was a piece of cake compared to what I had done in the military.
Okay. Well, I guess we should go ahead and step back then and go back to your early experiences. And if you would, do you remember some of the first missions you went on, you know, what they were like? What was different about flying for Air America versus the Army, that kind of stuff?
Well, what I was doing in the Army was medical evacuation. Now, a number of those people would just be sick. You know, we'd get calls for a fever of unknown origin or a malaria case or something like that, just routine stuff. But you know, when you get a call that they have four Americans with gunshot wounds, well, somebody shot them, you know, and whoever shot them is probably going to shoot at you, too. So it was not unusual at all to take fire on a medevac, and it was not that unusual to be hit. You know, we got shot up on a fairly regular basis, I guess. You know, oftentimes not seriously. In fact, most times not seriously. I think in the 18 months I flew that sort of stuff, I only had two guys on the aircraft actually hit. The rest of them were things that were, you know, caused no serious damage. Never had an aircraft disabled, you know, to where I couldn't get it home anyway.
Well, what was the heaviest thing that you were hit with?
You mean the heaviest armament?
Heaviest weapon, yes, sir.
Just small arms.
Just small
arms. Never got hit with anything as big as a 50, which is probably AK stuff.
Uh-huh.
I've not been shot at with other stuff. They weren't successful.
Okay.
RPGs and mortars.
Uh-huh.
But their aim was not that good, and we were pretty quick.
Yes, sir. What were you flying for Air America?
Bell 204Bs.
Okay.
Which is a Huey, essentially.
How did you like it compared to the Hueys you were flying for the Army?
Oh, they were wonderful aircraft. They were very well maintained. I always thought that of that whole series, and that's a series that's been in production for God knows how many years and in innumerable versions, that I thought the 204 actually flew about as well as any of them, because I've always speculated it was the closest to the original design, and maybe that's why it worked as well as it did. Our aircraft were also pretty light, although we had a smaller engine than the Army did in their H models. Our airframes were lighter, so we could actually haul a bigger load, or at least be competitive with them.
Okay.
I remember on occasion working side by side with the Army for MACV, you know, sort of alternating loads with them, and we were getting off the ground with bigger loads than they were because we had a lighter airframe.
Okay. did that translate into less protection?
Well, yes, because we didn't have all the armament they had. We did have armored seats, but we didn't have the sliding panels and some of the other things that had come along later. And of course, we didn't have guns, so that's a lot of weight that you save there. And we only carried 3 crew members. They carried 4.
Okay. Well, who were you paired up with? Was it on a regular basis that you would fly with the same person, or did
you switch around? Fly with anybody.
Oh, okay.
However it shook out, crew scheduling handled all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And that was a major task in itself, scheduling crew members,
mm-hmm.
because part of our pay, I'm sure you've heard this, but part of our pay was based on flight hours. So there was always an attempt to keep everyone's flight hours pretty equal,
mm-hmm.
Because it meant money.
Yes, sir.
And when crew scheduling had a problem doing that, they heard about it.
And who handled the crew scheduling principally?
Well, that was done by, I don't know who was in charge of that ultimately, but it was done by a little office full of Vietnamese people that ran that.
Okay. Well, who comprised your crew consistently? Did you fly with some of the same people quite a lot? Or?
Well, yeah, because there weren't that many of us in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to know everybody very well.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, now, of course, at that time I was a co-pilot. I got there in June of 71, and I was a co-pilot until early 73.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot in that role, because there is truly an art to being an effective co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to tailor the way you approach the job according to who you're flying with. So you get to know the various individuals you're flying with, and you do it the way they want it done. And they all want it done slightly differently. And they all have different personalities. So you have to
mm-hmm.
you have to become somewhat skilled at the interpersonal relationships, too.
Yes, sir. Who do you remember flying with?
Who?
Yes, sir.
Well, probably the most memorable was a guy named Bill Mauser.
Okay.
This is in Saigon now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I don't know whether you've heard of him. He was a retired colonel.
Okay.
And a fellow that a lot of people had difficulty getting along with. I never had a problem with Bill at all, because I figured out how to get along with him. So we had some, relatively enjoyable times. But I remember all the people. Larry Stadulis was the one of the Czech pilots. And I remember him. All of them, really, if you went down through a list, I would know them all.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, some of them that I flew with earlier in Saigon then transferred to Thailand.
Okay.
And, were gone and replaced by someone else. Izzy Friedman was another one that I flew with in Saigon. He had come down from Thailand to help out for some reason, and flew with us for a couple of months there. And I really, really enjoyed flying with Izzy.
Anybody else stick out in your mind?
Brian Johnson,
mm-hmm.
whom you know. I got the initial checkout in Saigon from Brian.
Okay.
And then later on, he went to Thailand shortly after we got there. So I didn't fly with him operationally that much until I got to Thailand, and then I was in the same program he was in Thailand, so I flew with him up there, too, and quite enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. And, let's see, how about, did you ever get to know any of the customers?
I knew some of the customers in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that many. You would know them by their call sign, and you just work for them, but I didn't have the sort of personal relationship with the customers in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of the guys who'd been up there longer did. I was only there for 6 months.
In Thailand?
And while I was there, I was, in Thailand, Laos.
Okay.
The base was Thailand, but the operations were in Laos.
Yes, sir.
And I was just a co-pilot, so I was sort of kept my mouth shut and stayed out of the way and did my job. So I didn't have that much first-hand interaction with the customers in Laos.
Do you remember any customers from Saigon?
I'd be reluctant to say names, actually.
Okay. How about their call signs?
The one that sticks in my mind is call sign with hotel.
Okay. Now, do you recall the nature of some of the operations you supported flying in Saigon? Of course, because by the time you got there, the U.S. had been heavily winding down the war and withdrawing American forces, Vietnamizing the war, as Nixon called it. And so U.S. conventional forces were minimizing rather significantly. What was it like for the agency side of the war that you supported, flying customers
Well, again,
around Saigon.
It was really pretty routine. It really wasn't all that exciting, quite frankly. There would be occasions, of course, where somebody might decide to pop around at you or something. But most of what we did, it was either resupply or it was liaison type of stuff, where you just carry somebody in somewhere and they would have a meeting and you don't know what they're doing. You just drop and you wait until they come back to the helicopter. And you don't ask questions because it's none of your business. All you're doing is furnishing transportation. On the one that I did mention with the Navy, that was a construction project, and we were just carrying the boss around so he could stay up with how the project was going. And we'd carry food, and we carried a lot of supplies, mainly food, really, to places that were remote. But it really wasn't direct military stuff. It was the support efforts.
Was it very consistent work? I mean, in terms of you were pretty much always busy?
Oh, yeah. You could go out and a good day was a 10-hour day. Often you wouldn't get that much, but, of course, the more the better because you're getting paid somewhat by the hour. It was a rather complex pay system, but mm-hmm. Your flight hours did matter.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you got, the happier you were.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you could get nice long days, because by the end of the month, crew scheduling was trying to get everyone equal.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could get your 100 hours in by banging out 10-hour days, of course, which wouldn't happen, but theoretically, you'd have a 10-day month, where another guy who was flying 5 hours a day would have a 20-day month.
And was you said the 10-hour days were good, but not very common. What was a typical day? More like 8?
Geez, that's a real tough one, because it would range anywhere from a couple hours up to 10.
Okay.
Maybe an average day was 6.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's just a wild guess.
Now, was there a ceiling or a limit on how much you could fly per day?
I'm sure there was. I don't remember what it was. 100 hours a month sticks in my mind as a maximum month.
Okay.
But again, a lot of these things, there are all kinds of rules, and then there are always attempts to bend rules.
Right.
And in an environment like that, in the end, by and large, you just do what you have to do to get the job done.
Yes, sir.
That was the way I looked at it, and I think most other people did, too. I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to rules. That was one of the things that I think a lot of us liked about a job like that, was that you didn't have a lot of rules.
Yes, sir.
Or if you had them, you could ignore them.
So, do you remember what rules you tended to ignore?
Oh, just about anything I wanted to.
okay.
I do remember one occasion where it had been where the chief pilot had been very adamant, and of course this was later on, and this was after I was a captain, and we had some operations in Saigon that were single pilot crewed, and some that were two pilot crewed,
mm-hmm.
and there had been a very adamant directive that had come down saying that the co-pilot seat, if it had control, and of course they always had controls because they were, configured for two pilots, that we were not supposed to put customers up there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the kind of thing that was, sometimes ignored. It was, the way it was handled was pilot discretion, basically.
Okay.
But I chose to adhere to that rule because it had been sort of not a threatening letter, but the chief pilot had been very adamant that customers were not supposed to sit in a pilot seat with controls.
Okay.
And a customer walked out one day and just started to climb into the front seat, and I told him, no, I'm sorry, you can't sit there. And that got to be a little bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He was not happy, but he did get in the back, and
okay.
The guy who was running that base came out and said, what's the problem? And I explained to him what the problem was. I said, look, if you tell me it's okay, I don't have a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're putting me between a rock and a hard place here. The chief pilots tell me absolutely do not do that, and you're telling me to do it. So somebody tell me it's okay, because it's my job you're talking about.
Right.
And nobody would say it's okay, so he got in the back seat and away we went.
Okay. Were there many special missions flown out of Saigon while you were there?
No. In terms of, like, special projects?
Yes, special project mission.
I don't know of any.
Okay.
Not while I was there in the helicopter program.
Okay. So you never flew one out of Saigon?
No.
Okay.
And I don't know of any that were flown out of Saigon.
Okay.
There may have been, but if it happened, it happened very, very quietly, and I would think I would have known about it.
Yeah. Well, there were some pretty interesting projects going on in Vietnam throughout this period. One of them involved a group called the PRUs, the Provincial Reconnaissance Units.
Uh-huh.
Do you know if you ever provided support for them?
Well, I think we probably did, yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What did you hear about them while you were there?
Well, my understanding of the PRUs, if I'm getting my initials right, was that they were pretty hardcore sort of mercenary-type troops that worked for the agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they were the ones, mercenary might not be the right word, because I don't know exactly who they were. I might be getting them mixed up with the CIDGs, too. My understanding of the PRU is that they were basically the people that were implementing the Phoenix program. Am I right on that?
Yes, sir. I think so.
Yeah. And, of course, the Phoenix program became somewhat notorious.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of got out of hand from my understanding of it. But, yes, we did. We would carry them occasionally, or carry people that would be going to coordinate with them.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, like, making an assault into somewhere or that kind of thing, it was nothing I ever did.
Right. No, I did, in terms of either providing transportation, support, in terms of supplies, you know, resupply ammunition, things like that.
Yeah, I think we did. Certainly that term is familiar with me,
mm-hmm.
or familiar to me. And I'm sure that we did carry people in support of them.
Now, did you fly many non-Americans?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We flew whoever the customer told us to put on.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes we would have Vietnamese, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do payrolls, for example, take people around base-to-base, paying folks.
Oh, wow.
In fact, there were a couple of jobs that were routine payroll
okay.
runs.
Mm-hmm.
Every Tuesday you'd hit all these little bases.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be it. I really can't recall specifically, but I'm sure we carried Vietnamese. I mean, hell, it was their country.
Right. Well, how about prisoners? Did you ever transport prisoners from the field back to headquarters?
I don't have any specific recollection of that. Certainly may have.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I do now that you mention it. I sort of remember making a trip to Phu Quoc Island on some sort of a prisoner thing, because we had there was a big POW camp out there.
Yes, sir.
And that had we went out there having something to do with a POW camp, but I don't remember the specifics on that flight now.
Okay.
But I did carry any number of prisoners when I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when you carried them for the Army, were they principally wounded prisoners, or were these guys that needed to be carried
back?
Yeah,
we were carrying them because they were wounded.
Okay. Just as dust-off pilots, you're carrying the wounded.
Right.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, I remember picking a guy up one time who was a youngster. He was maybe 15, 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called in as a wounded DC with gunshot wounds or whatever. So we picked him up at a firebase. And on the way to the hospital, the kid spoke English. And he asked the medic if we were the 57th Med Detachment. He said, yeah. And he said, where are you taking me, to Delta Med in Lac A? Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we are. How'd you know all this?
Yeah, really?
He knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Another one we picked up in the Yumin Forest down in the Delta was kind of funny, because the medic had said, hey, turn around and look at this guy. Turn around and looked at him, and again, he was another kid about 16, 17 years old, wearing a University of Colorado T-shirt,
which
we thought was kind of funny.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anything memorable like that when you were flying for Air America? Weird passengers that stuck out in your mind? Or interesting passengers?
Nothing that really jumps out at me.
Okay.
One of the things that I would interject here that might be a point of interest, at least it always was to me,
mm-hmm.
Was that, we had a flight information center
mm-hmm.
in Saigon, and every day before you went out on your flight, if you were based in Saigon, you'd go in every day. If you were going up country, of course, you'd check in there before you went up to do your 6 days up country.
Mm-hmm.
And there you'd get a briefing as to what the latest deal was on what was going on in that area. And I always felt like we had probably the best intelligence of anybody in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got our information from, well, part of the deal was when you got back at night or back from an RON,
mm-hmm.
then you would also go into to FIC and tell them what you knew, you know, to update them on what you found out in the last few days. And as a result, we got our information from virtually everybody that was working in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a problem over there, and it perhaps still exists, of the various groups hoarding information. You know, MACV doesn't tell the Navy, and the Navy doesn't tell the embassy, and the embassy doesn't tell somebody else on down the line. So
right.
I've seen it oftentimes. You go out and work for somebody, and they tell you, okay, we want to go from here to here. And we say, well, do you know there's you know, there's been a reported 50 caliber machine gun at this location where he wants to fly right by. Oh, no, no, I didn't. Where'd you hear that? Well, we got that last week from somebody else in your area. Somebody wearing a different hat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obvious that these folks didn't trade information, but we got it from all sources, so we generally knew what was going on about as well as anybody.
Mm-hmm. And so, and compared to the Army, your Army experience, this was a vast improvement.
Well, in terms of total intelligence, yeah.
Yeah,
we had a better big picture probably than anyone.
Yeah.
Again, because we got it from all the various groups.
Now, when you say you'd go up country for 6 days, where would you typically go, or where did you go when you went on your six-day up country?
Well, we had bases in starting from the south, Canto. Excuse me, Canto, Saigon. Oh, boy.
You want to take a minute and get a drink?
No, let me clear my throat here. Canton, Pleiku, Nha Trang, and Da Nang.
Okay. Was there any place in particular you enjoyed more?
Well, Canto was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Nha Trang was great because it was a wonderful
mm-hmm.
beach resort town.
Yeah.
Da Nang, I didn't... I'm talking about just... I'm not talking about the work. I'm talking about just the city.
Yes, sir.
Da Nang was not particularly attractive, and Pleiku was horrible.
Okay. And how about the work? Did it change or differ from place to place at all?
Well, it would at any given time, depending on, you know, where the interesting, where the hot spot was.
Yes, sir.
Da Nang could tend to be kind of more active, shall we say. Pleiku was later on.
Mm-hmm.
That was after the ceasefire when we established a base up there.
Okay.
And our operations at Pleiku were essentially for the ICCS function, which was the peacekeeping group.
Okay.
And that was a whole different ball of wax. You know, that was a whole different deal.
Mm-hmm.
Canto was a nice place to be, but, you know, as far as the way you live when you
mm-hmm.
got off work.
Mm-hmm.
And Nha Trang was the same thing. Nha Trang was interesting because you had covered a pretty big area, and the country was absolutely beautiful up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed flying up there just for the scenery.
Were all these places equally manned as far as the number of personnel working and supporting them?
Well, we usually had two helicopters at Canto. I think generally about two helicopters each. I couldn't say that for certain, though.
Okay.
I would say that the staffing was essentially the same,
mm-hmm.
very close anyway.
How about compared to Saigon?
Well, Saigon, of course, was the main base. So
right, so you had significantly more there.
Oh, that yeah, all the major support was from Saigon.
Right.
When the aircraft would go to an outstation, it would stay there until it was approaching some sort of more significant maintenance requirement,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then it would be ferried back to Saigon for the maintenance, and they'd replace it with something else.
Okay. Now, who was doing the routine maintenance on this aircraft? This was the one person that you were carrying. You said, wait, you had a crew of three. You, the co-pilot, and I guess a crew chief?
A crew chief, yeah. The nightly maintenance would be done by the crew chief.
No, was this an American, a Vietnamese, or some other nationality, or combination?
Most of them were Filipinos.
Oh.
You know, they came from different places. We had
mm-hmm.
a number of Filipinos.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had one Chinese fella.
Mm-hmm.
And at some times we had Americans. At some times we had no Americans.
Okay.
there had been a lot more of Americans there, and they'd sort of phase them out and move the Americans up to Thailand.
Mm.
And then as things wore down in Thailand, we ended up with more Americans down in Saigon.
Okay.
And of course, after the ceasefire, we got 30-something additional aircraft, I think, from the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a big buildup at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we had more Americans, crew chiefs then.
Okay. Now, could you give me the date span that you were in Saigon, working in South Vietnam? That would have been from June of 71 until...
With Air America, it was June of 71 until October or November of 72.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to Thailand / Laos
uh-huh.
until, I think, about April of 73.
Okay.
And then came back to Saigon and stayed in Saigon until April of 75.
And who did you work for? This was still Air America, right?
Yeah, oh, that whole thing was Air America.
Yeah, the whole thing's Air America.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Let's see, so when you went, during that whole, the first period from June 71 until late 72, you were flying all over the country in South Vietnam. Did you ever fly into Cambodia or Laos while you were in South Vietnam?
Cambodia, not Laos.
Okay. What was going on there?
I'm trying to remember the timing on that. There was a mission that was started there
mm-hmm.
in Cambodia that was in support of the Cambodians.
Was this part of the Cambodian incursion, or?
It would have been after that because I was in the army when the incursion
that's right.
happened.
That's right.
So this, I don't know where this happened. This must have happened it's hard for me to reconstruct the dates now.
Okay.
I know we were going in there in 73. I can't recall whether we were going in there before I went to Laos in late 72 or not.
Okay.
But when I came back, we certainly were going in there routinely.
Okay. Well, continuing with your time in South Vietnam, you've already discussed one of the major things that occurred during the Easter Offensive of 72. I was wondering if you would describe what you remember most about that whole time period when the Easter Offensive kicked off in late March of 72 and... you know, as it continued and progressed, what were you guys doing as far as support? Did you in terms of specific operations you might remember, or specific flights, things like that?
Well, mainly what we were doing was the same sorts of things we had always done.
Mm-hmm.
The real activity was happening essentially from way north.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly what we were doing up there was flying embassy customers. The ones that I remember, anyway. I'm sure we were doing MACV and all the rest, but the ones that I found the most interesting was flying this one particular embassy customer. There were actually a couple of them, and they were trying to get a handle on what the hell was going on. And we'd go up there in the morning from Da Nang and fly into Hue and stop in Hue, and the customer would talk to his people in Hue and find out, how were things up to the next sort of outpost north of Highway 1? And so he'd get back on and say, okay, let's go up to the next place. So we'd go up there and he'd confer with somebody. And they'd get an on-the-spot report of how are things this morning. And then we'd go up until we hit the point where we couldn't go any further because we no longer owned that territory. But it was changing so rapidly. I mean, that whole thing was just, nobody knew what the hell was going on. This embassy customer we were flying had a better handle on it than just about anyone, I would think. Because he had any number of people that worked for him, and he knew them all by name. And he had better intelligence about what was happening on the ground probably than just about anyone. And it was a very, very confusing situation and changing hourly. The whole thing sort of changed. I remember this particular customer telling me at one point they had come down so fast, and Hue had always been a sort of a choice target. The other side had always wanted to take Hue. That was what was a big deal in '68, and they had advanced very rapidly to within easy striking distance of Hue, and then just sat still and didn't do anything. And then the weather changed. During that period, one of the things that had helped them was the weather was bad, which limited our air capabilities as far as the Air Force, bombing and that kind of thing. And, you know, they could have had way, really, but they didn't take it. And we kind of wondered why. And this customer ultimately told me that they had found a Vietnamese lieutenant, I believe, a North Vietnamese lieutenant, you know, dead, and had gone through through what he had on him, and discovered that the apparent reason they hadn't gone ahead and taken away was that, and this was because of written documents the fellow had on him, that they had been told to advance to certain locations and await further orders. And they were very, very disciplined, and apparently their system didn't allow for initiative at the local level as much as Americans would have allowed that. So these guys got to where they were going way ahead of where the Vietnamese command thought they would be in terms of time, and they just sat down and waited for orders, which never came until it was too late. So that was kind of that was the explanation I was given for why they never took way when they had the chance originally. But I thought it was sort of an interesting anecdote regarding the different approach militarily. And again, this goes back to this one particular customer who definitely knew what was going on.
Yes, sir. Well, of course, there were three major prongs to the Eastern Offensive, so they hit not just north, but in the center, and then also in the south, north of Saigon. Do you remember any of the operations that you supported in those other areas, or were you at all active in those other areas?
Well, I'm sure I was. I don't remember so much going on down around Saigon. There was always threats of somebody coming over, you know, from the sort of the Angels Wing area, was it? Or the Parrot's Beak?
Parrot's Beak?
Yeah, Parrot's Beak. Coming over from that direction, you know, and that kind of thing. But I don't have any specific recollection of that.
Okay.
Maybe that was because I was spending an awful lot of time in Da Nang. It seemed like I was living up there for a while. And I suppose that's why I remember that most, because that's where I was during that period of time. But it was very active up there. And then even south of Da Nang also. I do remember one customer telling us this was in an area back in sort of in a valley going back into the mountains south of Da Nang. They'd had reports of tanks back there. And upon investigation, it turned out they were cardboard silhouettes of tanks mounted on bicycles and tape-recorded tank sounds. And it had just really spooked the local Vietnamese, because they, you know, they saw these cardboard cutouts from a distance and heard these tank noises being broadcast by tape, and, you know, they just packed up and ran.
Interesting psychological operation.
Oh, well, they were pretty clever, I'll have to say. Our enemy knew what they were doing.
Did you or any other Air America pilots that you know participate in American PSYOPs? You know, leaf drops?
Well,
like
I remember
that?
Doing leaflet drops, yeah.
Okay.
Now, that was in 3 Corps that I specifically remember doing that. But, yeah, we did get involved in that sort of thing. I never knew how productive it was, but...
Mm-hmm.
It was flight time, so...
Okay. That's what mattered. Okay. And what about after the Easter Offensive, until you left? Anything
well,
stand out in your mind?
Not particularly. I do remember that, again, you sort of fast forward. You know, Quang Tri, as I recall, was the third largest city in the country. And the way they ultimately sort of broke the back of the Easter Offensive was the weather cleared and they just bombed the hell out of Quang Tri. Because the bad guys had taken Quang Tri. And then we retook it by bombing them out of there. And then subsequent to that, I don't remember going back, getting that far north. And it's hard for me to reconstruct the timing, but after returning to Saigon from 6 months in Laos, I did have occasion to go up to Quang Tri, and it was just amazed at the devastation. There was not one structure left standing intact in that entire city. It was leveled. Now, there was the occasional one wall still up, but they just completely obliterated that city. That really made an impression.
Yes, sir. Now, how much during this time that you're back in Saigon, working for Air America, how much are you interacting with the Vietnamese civilian population?
Oh, quite a lot. I mean, we lived on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
My landlord was a Vietnamese. I had a Vietnamese girlfriend who subsequently became my wife. We were around Vietnamese all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we lived.
Mm-hmm. Were there any rules about your interaction with Vietnamese?
Not that I recall.
Okay.
I mean, obviously we were encouraged to treat people with respect and that sort of thing.
Of course.
But I don't remember any specific rules.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember when I first arrived in Laos for the initial ground school, being at one of the local watering holes one night, being introduced as a new guy, and one of the old-timers said, was going to offer some advice about how to stay out of trouble. And his advice was to don't talk in public about what you do. Don't talk politics, and don't give the locals a hard time. And that was his three pieces of advice.
Hmm.
And I thought it was pretty good advice.
Yes, sir. Didn't you try to follow it?
Oh, I did follow it, yeah. It's still pretty good advice.
Yeah, yes, sir, it is. So, as far as not talking politics, did he mean in the context of the politics of the war or local politics?
No, I think both.
Okay.
And the inference was, of course, in a public setting. Don't sit around a bar and talk politics, in other words.
Okay.
If you're at home talking to one of your buddies, you can talk about whatever you want to.
Right.
But publicly avoid those things.
Hmm. Well, I would imagine that you were in the company of people, of mostly men, who shared a rather conservative philosophy, very very much in support of what the United States was trying to do in Southeast Asia.
Oh, yes. I would say, generally speaking, that's true. There are always some exceptions.
Yeah.
We all, by and large, believed in what we were doing.
Right.
We thought we were doing the right thing.
Yes, sir.
Everybody had pretty good motives. Even the people that were over there, and there were some, that had short-term goals, largely financial in mind,
mm-hmm.
Still believed in what they were doing. I don't think there was anybody over there who thought we shouldn't be there. They might have thought we were mishandling it in some ways, or as it drug on, I suppose some people might have been saying, what the hell are we doing here, But you didn't hear that much.
Mm-hmm.
If there was any... the questioning, it had more to do with how we were handling it rather than the fact that we were there.
Okay. What do you remember as far as some of the criticisms of how we were conducting the war during your time with Air America?
Oh, I think it would have run the gamut. There are always people who want to bomb them to the Stone Age, mm-hmm. and there are always people who want to win the hearts and minds, and I would say the whole spectrum.
Interesting.
You have to remember that we all come ultimately from the same society.
Right.
So you're going to have a wide range of views, although we would be on the conservative end of that range, I would think,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking,
mm-hmm.
The so-called more right wing.
Yes.
When I say right wing, of course, there were a lot of people that were, that you have to be more specific in terms of what area were you talking about? I mean, there were people who were very liberal in some areas of their thinking who
mm-hmm.
still thought the war was, that we were trying to do a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a range of views, I think. But there really wasn't a whole lot of talk about it,
yeah.
quite frankly. We were a bunch of young fellows,
yeah.
largely, especially the helicopter people.
Mm-hmm.
And when the day's work was done, we were ready to socialize.
Right. And that meant going and enjoying yourself.
Oh, having a few drinks or hanging out in a bar or
right.
looking for ladies or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But at that stage, the war would be on, you know, you just go do your job in the daytime, and you come back and pick up your life.
Yes, sir. Now, when you were in Saigon, or in South Vietnam, were there any specific watering holes you remember? Were there any consistently?
Geez, by name, I can't. Well, there was a bar across the street from where I lived,
Okay. Which
was very handy to me because I could stay there past curfew and just dash across the street.
Okay.
And there were a couple of other places that were open all night long.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any trouble being out after curfew. I've walked home from, you know, of course you wouldn't. If you stayed past curfew, you're not going to get a ride home
because
there aren't any taxis or anybody out, and I didn't have my own vehicle.
Right.
So I'd end up walking home, and I remember walking home, curfew was like midnight, I think, and I remember coming home at 2 or 3 in the morning and being stopped by MPs, but more often than not, they'd just give me a ride home.
Oh, okay.
In exchange for, I'd give them all a beer when we got home or whatever, and they were happy with that.
Okay.
Nobody ever really gave me a hard time.
Mm-hmm. And as Air America personnel, you were still supposed to abide by the curfew?
Oh, technically, yeah.
Technically.
We didn't have a pass or anything that allowed us to ignore it.
So, we were
supposed to, but it didn't. Americans could get away with things over there that others couldn't.
Now, did you have, what was the recourse if someone did try to give you too hard of a time, especially if it was someone military? I mean, was there like a number you would tell them, please call this number, and they would just tell them to leave you alone so you get on with your business?
Or? No, I was never aware of any free pass of that nature.
Okay.
And I know I don't know personally, but I know of cases of people getting picked up for one thing or another and ended up in jail.
Wow.
Ultimately, we were subject to their laws.
Yes, sir.
But their laws could be bent if you had a little money in your pocket.
Okay.
And I guess that was ultimately your way out, but I never did sort of like that approach, so I would usually, if I had a confrontation with the local policeman, usually his whole effort was aimed at getting a bribe. And I would just stall and stall until they finally say, oh, get out of here. Because if he had to, I've been threatened to, I'm going to have to haul you in, for what you did. And I said, well, I didn't do what you said I did. And they go back and forth. And, they usually play the good cop, bad cop deal.
Uh-huh.
And one of them would say, pay my buddy 500p and, he can, I'll calm him down. Or else we're going to have to take you to the station. I said, well, take me to the station. Well, they know if they take you to the station, they're not going to get the money. Then the sergeant's going to get the money.
Uh-huh.
And that'll take them off their corner where they might be hitting someone else up for a bribe.
That's right.
So ultimately, they just tell you to get the hell out of here. So I usually was successful in wearing them down.
Now, was that a piece of advice you got from someone else? You just figured that one out?
No, I just was hard-headed enough. I wasn't going to pay a bribe.
Okay. Well, let's take a break for a moment, sir. We're back from our break. I just wanted to also ask you about American military personnel and how much you had interaction with them during your first tour with Air America in Saigon or South Vietnam.
Well, of course, we've worked for them a lot because one of the normal tasks we would have would be to go work for MACV. So we worked with them. MACV was the military. And we worked a lot with MACV. Perhaps more than anyone,
mm-hmm.
at least as much as anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of interaction that way, and then socially we would run into them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was a fair amount of interaction there.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that you get really good intelligence from your own information center. Were there any rules about not sharing that information, or was it pretty much okay? Like you mentioned, you would be talking with people, and you'd say, well, there's a 50 cal there or some other hazard that might exist. Was it okay for you guys to do that openly, frequently? Or?
Oh, yeah, generally speaking, yes. There may have been occasions where we were told that something was not to be mentioned.
Okay.
But it would have been pretty rare. And if it was something that of a nature like that that could have impacted someone else in a negative sense,
mm-hmm.
I don't recall ever being told don't share that information.
Okay.
In fact, I do seem to have specific recollections of visiting. You know, we would get these congressional visits occasionally, or other dignitaries or important people of some sort coming over from the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember them sometimes going by FIC for a briefing.
Mm-hmm. And would you also ferry them around at all?
On occasion, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, was there anything else you wanted to discuss with regard to your first tour with Air America in Saigon?
No, sir. I think we're pretty well covered.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and discuss the events that led up to moving to Thailand, Laos, and what was different about flying there?
Well, that had come about because at that time there was still a pilot's union, so things were done on a seniority basis if an opening came available. And a lot of us wanted to go to Thailand anyway. That was, that was where the action was. And the money was better up there as well. But it was really more about being where the action was than it was about the money.
Mm-hmm.
And a chance to fly different aircraft. So an opening came up in Udor. And I bid for it and got it. And, based on seniority. And some of my buddies had left earlier, on similar deals. So I got up there and had actually bid a job in the H-34, the old round motor H-34.
Mm-hmm.
And when I arrived, I went in to talk to the local head of the pilots union, or association, as some people call it, PIPA. And he told me that there was also an opening in the 58T program, which was a somewhat modernized version of that same aircraft. And he said, this is really a better deal. You know, you sure you want to do the H-34? You want to swap over to this other one? I said, oh, yeah, it's a better deal. I'll do the other one. So that's what I did. And so I went through the checkout on that. Well, I went through the ground school first because it was an aircraft I was not familiar with at all. And so I went through several days of ground school and then did the flight training and started flying up country. And I very much enjoyed it. I love that aircraft, and I was flying with wonderful people. The work was very interesting. We were working out of 20 Alderman, and that was where we were sort of basing up country. But we would go up north from there on occasion, and I really loved that work. It was a lot of fun, and I learned more there in 6 months than I had learned in the previous 3 years I've been flying, I guess, because mountain flying is a whole different thing. So it was very educational.
Mm-hmm. Now, and what was this aircraft again?
The 58T.
Okay.
Which was a twin-turbine version of the old H-34.
Quite powerful, wasn't it?
Yeah, in that day, and, in context, it was a good aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had some teething problems, but, you always have problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get into some of the specifics of the operations you conducted there, but you mentioned that the pilots' union still existed. Now, when you first went to work for Air America, were you approached to join a union? Did you join the union?
Oh, yes, and I think there was a probationary period. You sort of, I think you had to be there 6 months or a year or something like that before you could really, you were still subject to to be fired or other kind of action that the union couldn't intercede for you,
mm-hmm.
up to whenever your probationary period was over. But you were encouraged to join the union anyway,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that you were sort of a provisional basis. And then after your probation period was over, then you were in the union if you chose to be. There
mm-hmm.
were those who chose not to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember any such thing as union dues, whether we even had them, I don't know.
Hmm. Did you choose to join?
Yes.
Okay. what did you think about the idea of a pilot's union when you first heard about it?
Well, I just thought that was the way it was done. I mean, this is my first civilian job.
Okay.
So I really didn't have much basis to make a decision one way or another. I was brand new.
Uh-huh.
I'd never flown civilian before, and they had a union. 99% of the people were in it. So
okay.
I just sort of joined without thinking about it, really.
Okay. Did you ever talk with anyone who decided not to join the union and find out why?
I know one individual who did not join the union, and I never really had an in-depth discussion as to why. He just didn't want to, and he didn't. But I don't know what his reasoning was.
Okay.
I always respected that choice.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, when you went to fly the 5018, you learned in ground school, you learned how to fly it. What were the biggest challenges to flying that versus the other aircraft you'd flown previously?
Well, it was a bigger, heavier aircraft. And it had some anomalies at the time because of being a twin engine. It was a sort of a hybrid. It was two engines driving through one gearbox. And there were some sort of weird things that it would do if one engine was acting up. There was a torque control unit that was supposed to take care of power sharing and match the torques one engine versus the other and so forth. And that would tend to act up sometimes. And if it did act up, you had to know what to do. It was also subject somewhat to compressor stall. So you had to be able to recognize those and take corrective action. But it was generally a pretty nice aircraft to fly. I quite enjoyed it, and I still love that aircraft.
Yeah. And this is what you flew up at 20 alternate?
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and describe the nature of the operations you conducted there?
Well, at 20 alternate, it was again, that was largely resupply. There would be occasions when you would take troops into an area, for example, on some sort of a mission, whatever they were doing, an assault or whatever it might be. But 90% of it during the period that I was there, and I was there during kind of a lull period around the alternate anyway. There wasn't a whole lot going on at that time. It was largely resupply and mostly external load work. And we'd go out, you might go out and haul 120 sling loads in a day or something. It was real good work because you got a lot of takeoffs and landings. It was at altitude, real short trips, but just really working. It was a lot of fun. The big thing that was going on when I was there in that area was up at Site 32, and which was you couldn't get directly to Site 32 because we didn't own the PDJ at that time, and it was on the other side of the PDJ from the alternate. So you had to take quite a circuitous route to get there. But we go up there and work all day long and come home. And they had a bit of a siege going on during that period there, which lasted essentially the whole time I was there. It had just lifted before I left. But that went on for, I say essentially the whole time. It went on for 2 or 3 months, I guess. And that was kind of interesting. Because there was a lot of shooting going on during that deal.
What was the nature of that fire? Was it larger caliber fire, or was it still small arms?
Oh, they had 50s up there. And then there was a lot of incoming mortar, I guess it was probably, that sort of thing. 50s and mortars, I guess, primarily, and then small arms, of course. But we generally knew where the 50s were. That was the one that was, worried us the most. They did have anti-aircraft stuff in Laos. I never personally saw one. I never took fire from one. But they were known to be around.
Yes, sir.
And of course, as you know, we had aircraft hit with anti-aircraft fire. Yeah.
Now, while you were flying these missions in Laos, when you would go out on your mission, you'd do the same thing. I assume that you did in Saigon. First thing you do is you go to the Flight Information Center, get your briefing, and head out. Was the intelligence that you were getting there as good or better than what you were getting in Saigon?
Well, it was pretty good. As I recall, we'd go to FIC in New Dorm before you go up country.
Okay.
So you get a general overview there. Then when you got to the alternate, every morning you'd get a briefing before you started flying. And it would usually update you as to what had happened through the night. Because a lot of positions, it was very fluid. And so you'd get another briefing virtually every morning at the alternate, telling you, this is the latest deal. And this is what's going on at this location and that location. There was a vast number of little spots dotted all around the mountains there that we supported. And And, you know, they would say, well, we had bad guys down at this ballet last night or whatever. So you had pretty good intelligence. You knew what was going on,
uh-huh.
by and large.
Uh-huh.
At right in the local alternate area, anyway.
Uh-huh.
In the larger country, I really didn't say, because my exposure to Laos was very limited. It was just alternate and Site 32, really. Uh-huh. It was the only two. And some other sites, but those were the two main places that I worked.
Okay. Now, what had you heard about 20 Alternate before going to Laos? Anything?
Well, I was aware that it was, supposed to be the CIA's secret base in Laos,
uh-huh.
their major operation, at least in the northern part of the country. And that was about all I knew about it.
Okay. How much enemy activity was going on there while you were servicing there?
It was relatively quiet. My timing was such that I sort of missed some of the big moves that had happened before and after.
Mm-hmm.
It was relatively quiet. I mean, there was activity,
mm-hmm.
but it really wasn't all that hot when I was there. You know, you'd get shot at occasionally, but
mm-hmm.
It just was not that difficult from an enemy viewpoint right around the Alderman during that period.
Mm-hmm.
32 was where the action was. Where I was working at the time.
Because it was so close to the PDJ?
Well, I don't know if that was why.
Okay.
But the bad guys had decided they were going to take it,
mm-hmm.
and they mounted a siege that lasted quite a long time.
Do you remember?
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
Well, that was it. Basically, they were after it, and there was an awful lot of stuff they dumped on it over an extended period.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were there during the rainy season, huh?
Well, I was there, actually. I remember the smoky season as well.
Oh, the smoky season. Okay.
Well, I guess I don't remember how the seasons fall, but I definitely remember the smoky season.
Mm-hmm.
And probably part of the rainy season as well. Because I remember having a problem with both elements.
Okay.
During my brief 6 months up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I must have caught both of those, but I definitely remember the smoky season because I remember even down in Udorn,
mm-hmm.
The smoke from up north would be so bad in Udorn sometimes your eyes would water when you walk out of the house in the morning.
Mm.
And of course when you got up into Laos, it was really something. Forward visibility was nil, just about.
Mm-hmm. How would you navigate?
Well, you look straight down and you know where the valleys are.
Okay.
And you basically would fly pretty much established routes. I mean, you knew how to get from Bin Chin to the Alderman,
mm-hmm.
Because you knew what the valleys were. And you knew how to get from... we also had TACAM, which was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew how to get from the Alderman to Site 32, and that's just about all we were doing. And you could look straight down and see where you were. I mean, you had some forward visibility. It wasn't zero. You had enough to find your way around.
Right. And would you explain what that is?
What forward visibility?
No, the TACAM.
Oh, the TACAM. It's a navigational system. That I don't remember what the initials stand for. But it works similar to a VOR, except it also gives you a distance reading.
Okay.
So it would tell you what angle you were from the station and also at what distance.
Mm-hmm. And these were used. That was used to navigate to a specific location.
We didn't use it so much that way as it was just to tell you. You could look at a map and you could mm-hmm. say, okay, this point is, 40 miles on such and such an azimuth from the station.
Okay, and that would give you your location.
That would tell you where you were.
Yeah, and then you could figure out.
You look at a map and you see where you are and where you're going.
Right. Okay. Now, had you used that before going to Laos?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't used TACAM before because we didn't have it in Vietnam.
Okay.
But I was familiar with it. I mean, I from training in the military, I knew how it worked. It was
right.
Very simple to work,
mm-hmm.
and very helpful and pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You wouldn't. I wouldn't anyway. Try to shoot an approach down a valley in the blind with it. It wasn't like GPS or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty close.
Okay. Well, you said you made the comment that you learned more flying in those 6 months than you had the 3 years previous. Could you relate the more important lessons you learned flying there those 6 months?
Well, flying at altitude
is
different than flying at sea level because as you get higher and higher, aircraft performance decreases.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up having to you have to fly the aircraft a bit more defensively, shall we say. And you have to realize that you're, that same machine at sea level might be torque limited in that you could, you know, you could pull up to the maximum that the aircraft could take structurally.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas as you get up at altitude, you may not be you may not be able to produce that much torque. So now you're essentially engine limited, or whatever the parameter, or whatever parameter is going to top out first establishes your limit.
Mm-hmm.
And at altitude, you may not be able to get full torque. And even if you can get full torque, because of the decreased aerodynamic efficiency, you still may not be able to pick up the same amount of weight. So you had to pay a little bit more attention to weight and fuel and all those kinds of things. Also, the winds in the mountains can get kind of treacherous at times. So you have to be aware of what's going on environmentally and plan your approach accordingly. You know, plan your operations accordingly. And in an area like that where the terrain is so rugged, you have to be thinking about where am I going to go if I have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
What you ended up doing oftentimes on takeoff and on landing is planning your approach or your departure path such that if you have a problem, you have a valley to descend into or something,
mm-hmm.
somewhere to go. You don't want to roll down the side of a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the aircraft I was flying was much more forgiving than the old H-34s. They only had one engine and they were underpowered.
Mm-hmm.
So those guys really had to work hard.
Well, when you received your briefings, were you told whether it was Pathet Lao or North Vietnamese that you would be encountering if you went in a specific area?
We probably were. I don't specifically recall.
Uh-huh.
And I think most of what we were dealing with, well, I can't say that. I don't know who it was we were messing with up at 32.
Mm-hmm.
I think around around the Alderman was probably mostly PL.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically, I can't recall.
Okay. Well, when you were doing your work around Lima Site 32, that was at the time held by Bang Pao and the Hmong, correct?
Right.
Okay, and the other forces that surrounded laid siege to it. During that siege, did you help ferry men onto the PDJ to help bolster the defenses at all? Or?
No, I never have been on the PDJ.
Okay.
I've been at the edges, uh-huh. almost went in one day to you know, on a pickup of a downed airman.
Okay.
But we never could locate the guy, so we didn't go in.
Was this a fellow Air America pilot, or?
No, this was an Air Force guy.
Okay. Did you do any pilot pickups?
No, I never did.
Okay. Neither in Saigon or South Vietnam or nor in Laos?
No.
Okay. And during your time there in Thailand, Laos, obviously you mentioned already a lot of work ferrying, sling loads and things like that. Did you do a lot of troop carrying, personnel carrying?
Yes, we would. Not as much as some of the other guys did, just by, I don't know, the luck of the draw or the timing or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly what I ended up doing was hauling sling loads.
Okay.
But we would carry troops
as
well.
Now, of course, in Thailand, there were a lot of Thai soldiers and also Thai police, in particular the PARU, P-A-R-U, that were used to help train the Lao forces. Do you remember if you carried many of them up country to help train or continue training the Lao forces so that they could defend themselves?
The Thais that I specifically recall were what we called FAGs, which is Forward Air Guide.
Uh-huh.
And I do specifically remember them, and that's the only specific recollection I have of working with the Thai.
Okay.
They would be the guys that would sometimes direct us when we were up country.
Yeah. And when you were flying out of Thailand, do you remember or did you ever conduct operations into Cambodia from there?
No, I didn't, because I was up north.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think some of that may have occurred for the guys who were flying down, you know, down the panhandle.
Mm.
But it never happened where I was.
Okay. Well, as you were flying those missions into Laos, what did you think about how that operation was being conducted?
Well, I just sort of walked in there. I mean, this is the way it had always been done. I didn't really have much background.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, I was the new guy,
mm-hmm.
and learning.
Right.
And so it was all sort of new and amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought things were pretty well run.
Mm-hmm.
You had asked about customers before, and I'm sure you've heard people refer to a customer called Kayak.
Yes, sir.
And he was very involved in the Site 32 operation.
Okay.
And I always thought that from a customer viewpoint, he was probably an excellent man to have on your team.
Mm-hmm.
But from our standpoint, there was a problem in that he wasn't always honest with you.
Hmm.
And, you know, that can cause some difficulties. Especially, you know, I was relating it back to... you remember how I talked about our relationship when I was in the Army with the 1st Infantry Division,
mm-hmm.
and how advantageous it was to have people who tell you the truth.
Yes, sir.
And then I saw this individual who would tell you whatever he thought he needed to tell you to get you to come in fat, dumb, and happy.
Mm.
And that's not a good deal. And there were a lot of people who got very upset about that.
So in particular, you're talking about withholding information about, say, hot areas?
Yeah, I remember specifically at Site 32, in fact, you know, on one particular occasion, been working up there all day long. And so we knew what was going on because we'd seen the incoming. I mean, we were there, so we knew what the deal was. And we hear these guys coming in, C-46s or something, fixed-wing guys to make a rice drop. And they call a Kayak, and he tells them it's all quiet. So we called him on another radio that he couldn't hear and said, oh, shit, it's not all quiet. Here's what's really going on.
Hmm.
And, you know, because he was good. They would come in right over a 50 caliber machine gun.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So that was a problem when he would do that. And I never quite understood why he would, but he did.
Hmm.
In other respects, he was a pretty good hand. I mean, geez, he really did care about what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he had more energy than three men.
Hmm.
But he definitely had that one problem that upset a lot of folks.
Did you encounter that anywhere else while you were flying in Laos?
No, I don't. He was the only guy that I remember that really just sticks out in my mind as being somebody that you couldn't trust.
Hmm. As far as that information?
As far as that element.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, he was a pretty nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought his motives were probably okay.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't like his methodology.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever find out why he would tell pilots different?
No. Again, I was a co-pilot.
Okay.
And I had enough sense to stay clear of things that were better handled by someone else.
Yeah. Now, what was the in terms of the relationship between pilots and customers? Was there any difference between the experience in South Vietnam and Thailand, Laos?
I witnessed more occasions of sort of contentious relationships in Laos than I did in Saigon.
Hmm.
But that had primarily to do with the nature of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Saigon was pretty easy stuff. Whereas in Laos, sometimes we were asked to do things that were a little more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes that would occasion debates about the wisdom of this, or how are we going to do this? No, I don't like the way you want to do it. That kind of thing.
Mm.
I don't recall seeing that much in Vietnam, but I did see it in Laos.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in terms of the stuff that you would carry, especially sling loads, what was it typically you were carrying in those instances? Or was there just all kinds of stuff?
Well, all kinds. I would say the two broad categories would be food and ammunition.
Okay.
and water. We carried a lot of water around the Alderney because these guys were often on hilltops.
Mm-hmm.
And they owned the hill, but the bad guys owned the valley. And, of course, the water was down the valley.
Mm-hmm.
So we would carry drums of water to them.
And you would sling load those?
Yes.
To make it easier to drop them off on a hill?
Right.
Okay.
It's just that, yeah, it's easier all the way around. It's easier to pick up. It's easier to load. It's faster.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a better way to haul stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was the lift capacity of the 5018?
Wow, that's a good question. That environment, I've flown them since then.
Mm-hmm.
You pick up 5,000 pounds on the hook at sea level.
Wow.
Up in that area, with the kind of fuel loads we were carrying, maybe 3,000 pounds.
Okay. So that's a significant cut.
Well, again, when I'm saying pick up 5,000 pounds at sea level, that's if you're going to do a construction job and you're right on the site and you have just enough fuel to do the job.
Oh, okay. So you're not overloaded.
And you have a light aircraft and there's one pilot.
Gotcha.
But, you know, you get up at altitude, you have three crew members,
probably
with a little heavier aircraft because it's not, it has more in it than what you would do on a construction job.
Mm-hmm.
And you carry more fuel because you have a longer run to bank.
Mm-hmm.
So that would account for that weight.
Okay. Now, did you ever have to make any emergency landings in this, in the 5018?
The only problem I had up there was, I guess you would call it a precautionary landing.
Okay.
We had an aircraft that really started doing weird stuff. And we thought, actually, initially, we entered auto rotation because we thought we were going to have to go down. And then but we had enough altitude. We recovered and got things working enough that we could limp home on one engine.
Mm.
And, or didn't limp home, but got to a secure area and tried to sort it out back there. And ultimately ended up going back to the engine that night.
What did you discover what was wrong?
Strangely enough, ultimately we did, but we were not able to discover it that day. I think it ended up being a governor problem of some nature.
Mm.
That was rather a weird system because you had the two engines that were talking to each other, basically, through this torque control unit.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what would look to be the problem, for example, on number one engine, actually the source of the problem might be on the number two side. But because there was this interconnection, you get some really weird indication.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not always easy to figure out what was going on. Sometimes they just start changing stuff until they got to finally change something to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were flying in Laos, did you have occasion to pick up prisoners or anything like that? You know, kind of like what we're talking about with Vietnam.
I have no specific recollection of that, but it could have happened.
Okay.
You know, a lot of times you just don't know what you're doing, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, somebody, you know, you just land somewhere and they throw a bunch of people on, and away you go, and you don't know who they are.
Right. How many people could you fit in a 5018?
Space-wise, you could put 16 down below.
Mm-hmm.
Weight-wise, you wouldn't be able to step in here. 10 or 12, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, maybe you could even get 16 if they were, you know, locals.
Mm.
You know, you could pack it, and it depends on where you're taking off from and your altitude. Mm-hmm. If you're taking off from a runway, you can get a lot more off than if you're taking from a, you know, a small confined area somewhere up in the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were carrying really heavy loads, or when you were having problems maybe taking off at altitude, could you manipulate the 5018? Like I've heard Huey pilots talk about, you know, kind of skipping along until they hit translation.
Well, if you had room to run, yeah, but
yeah.
You had wheels on the 58T, so you could just roll.
You could roll.
Oh, yeah.
Until you hit translation and then take off.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. If you
had the space for it.
If you were on some sort of a runway or had an area to roll on.
Yeah.
Most of what we were doing was you know, on little, like, postage stamp pads on the top of hills.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things you could do on a place like that is get it up. You know, bring it up to a sort of an in-ground effect hover,
mm-hmm.
and then sort of jump off the side of the hill, and then you have the valley to get going in.
Okay. I'm sure that was interesting.
Well, it can actually be kind of fun.
I'll take your word for it. Were there any other missions or anything that stand out in your mind? Do you remember, people that you flew with?
I flew with some wonderful guys. My timing was probably pretty good in that program because we had a wonderful bunch of guys I was flying with. I flew with B.K. Johnson again in that program then when I got up there. I always liked flying with B.K. because he would let you do most of the flying, actually.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was the only guy in 4 years there that ever gave me a briefing before takeoff. And I remember very specifically because he said, I want you to keep all the paperwork and you'll be responsible for making all the radio calls, so all the position reports,
mm-hmm.
which had to be every 30 minutes, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you'll do at least half the flying, if not more. And he said, when you're flying the aircraft, it's your aircraft. If we have an emergency, it's your emergency unless I say I have it. And he said, don't fly to please me, fly to please yourself.
Hmm.
And if I see you doing something that I think is really stupid or unsafe, I'll mention it. But otherwise, don't try to figure out what I want you to do. You just do it the way you think it ought to be done. And that's the way he operated, and it was always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Nice management style.
Well, I thought it was.
Yeah.
I thought it was. He was a fun guy to fly with because he'd sit over there and just let you do your job.
Yeah.
Link Luckett, I don't know if you've heard of Link.
I have.
I was on a job. In fact, I think BK was the other. I don't know if it was BK or not. Anyway, Link was one of the pilots. And it was a two-aircraft mission into a hilltop above Site 32. And they wanted us to take some batteries up to a navigational aid that they had for the F-111 bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And they would use this thing, I guess, to help find their target. And they wanted us to take this up on this hilltop, but we knew that the bad guys had this place zeroed in with a 50. And so there was some question about whether this was a good idea or not, and were we going to get air support to do this. And the customer didn't want to provide the air support, and I was a co-pilot, so I'm just sort of a witness to this whole thing. So the debate is ongoing about whether we're going to get air support or not. And there was a time element involved, and it's mid-afternoon by now, and so forth and so on. And the one remark I remember, well, whoever the other captain was, the Link was one, somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And the other captain was really getting into a serious unpleasant debate with the customer about this thing. Hell no, we're not going to do this, so forth and so on. And Link pulled the two co-pilots aside in his unique way, said, you don't really need to get in a pissing contest with these guys. He said, never tell them you won't. Just don't. He said, you can just tell the mechanic to open up the clamshell doors on the front of that thing and start poking around. He said, hell, in another hour, it's going to be too late to go anyway. So Link would have just stalled. Just mess around, and pretty soon we'll have to go home anyhow.
That's an effective technique.
Well, Link has his own way of dealing with things,
mm-hmm.
and it's usually effective.
Yeah. Anybody else stand in your mind?
Oh, not in particular. I mean, there would be little things that would come up, but
mm-hmm.
One of the problems we used to have at down around Alderney would be some of the artillery batteries start firing without telling anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you're flying along, and all of a sudden you see these guys start shooting, and you're flying right through their GT line.
Mm-hmm.
And that would sometimes cause some problems. People get angry about that, want to shut down operations and all the rest. And that would cause some consternation. But that's the only other thing that sort of sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, while you were there in Laos, a lot of interesting events occurred in Vietnam. Of course, in December of 72, we had the Christmas bombing, and then in January of 73, the Paris Peace Accords. How were those events, how did they reach you? What did you think?
Well, generally everybody applauded the Christmas bombing. In fact, I happened to be, finally got to see Bob Hope after all those years out there, and saw him in Thailand. And while he was giving his show, he was interrupted continually by F-4s taking off because he was giving his show at the airbase in Utah. So I have that, you know, that sort of firsthand recollection of the bombing that was going on, in, you know, up around Hanoi. But that was generally felt, I think, by most people to have been the right thing to do, and the question was, why wasn't this done years before? Then, of course, the accords were signed. The union was busted. Things ran down in Laos, and I ended up going back to Saigon and in about April, I think. March or April, something around in there. And when I got to Saigon, of course, things had changed there dramatically because of the so-called peace.
Mm-hmm.
And we had inherited all these additional aircraft from the Army to gear up the ICCS operation. So we had a big influx of new people that had come in to man that operation. And that was a, you know, quite a different sort of operation than anything we'd done before.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that did stick out of my mind during that period of time, and I think I heard this when I was still in fact, I know I was still in Thailand, but a guy that I had shared a house with in Saigon had left Air America and gone back to the States and been in the States for maybe a year and decided he didn't like that and wanted to come back. So he had called D.C., asked if there was, you know, any chance of coming back. And I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we're hiring a lot of people because of this this ICCS thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they hired him back, and he'd been in country, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, I guess, when he got shot down up in the northern part of South Vietnam on an ICCS mission and was shot down and killed.
Oh.
And his name was Chuck Osterman. I don't know if you're familiar with that case, but it got a lot of press at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were on a mission that was supposedly cleared, and they got shot down while doing what they thought they were supposed to be doing.
Right.
And, of course, there were a lot of questions with that, you know, because they were, as it turned out, not where they were supposed to be.
Oh, okay.
And my company has just arrived.
Okay. Well, then maybe I should go ahead and let you go. We can pick this up. Why don't I send you a quick email,
And
we'll pick this up sometime, hopefully soon.
Okay.
But enjoy your weekend.
Oh, I'll do my very best, believe me.
And
you enjoy your holidays.
Thank you very much. Same to you, sir.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.